Pauline said she wasn't sure how I got let out of the house. Believe me, some Saturday mornings is getting kicked out of the house, is my experience. So it's really good to be among you this morning. And I really mean that. Thank you for what you do. Thank you for what you do in your groups. Thank you for what you do as leaders. Thank you for what you do to make disciples. And I'm not sure how to begin a talk to a room full of women, and I'm almost disappointed that I went this way, to be honest, but here we go anyway. This is George Clooney. Okay, that's landed with a few of you. Not just his photo, but what he said. Okay, this is a scene from the film Ocean's 11, and he gathers a group of basically his thieves and villains in the room. I'm not making any comparisons to that. But he gathers them in the room, and he's about to tell them his plan to rob, I think in this case it was a casino, and he was about to unveil it to them. And then he said, this brilliant scene, they're all beside a swimming pool, and silence falls over the group, and he says to them these words, "What I'm about to propose to you is both highly lucrative and highly dangerous." Highly lucrative on one hand, very exciting, okay, this could make you millions of pounds, and on the other hand, it might just kill you, okay, or we might get caught, and we might lose our freedom. And somehow, by him capturing those words or unveiling his plan in that way, this seemed to grab hold of these people, and he built a team around these words and this plan and this idea. And they were excited about getting involved in his plan. And I wonder if in some ways this is similar for Christian leadership. Now, not necessarily highly lucrative, okay? Some of you are looking around and thinking, I missed the memo. It's definitely not highly lucrative. But I wonder if we change that word to say highly exciting or highly rewarding. Sometimes we see those rewards on earth. Sometimes we get glimpses of those in our groups from week to week. Sometimes the reward for us, well, the future reward for us will be definitely assured. But sometimes it can also feel highly challenging, can't it? Draining, costly, frustrating. I think that's Christian leadership. I think that might be a picture of what you do. Rewarding when you see ladies benefit from what you do week by week, and challenging when you're trying to organize it. Or rewarding when you watch a woman grow in her faith over a period of time, and costly as you try to walk alongside her as well. Exciting in the sense that the primary call in our lives is to be followers of Jesus. Not before any role in a PW group or in a church leadership, our first call is to be followers. Before we are leaders, we are first disciples. Before you are planners, you are to be followers. But I think what I'm about to, but also, and so that's exciting, but also challenging, because being a disciple means that we are commissioned, we are called, and we are challenged to make disciples. We are to be disciples who make disciples, and that means challenge. That means a cost to our time, to our energy, to our lives, to our money even, and our resources and our gifts. And it also requires courage. It's highly exciting, but actually it's highly costly. And I think what I'm about to propose to you this morning is the same. It's extremely exciting, but it's really challenging too. And so my hope is that as you leave here this morning, or as I finish what I'm going to say, I hope you leave excited about the task, but I hope you also leave challenged as well. This morning I want us to turn to Luke chapter 24, to a time where Jesus transformed two of his followers from downcast doubters into devoted disciples, from moaners into missionaries. I don't know which of those two are the picture for your group or for people in your group, downcast doubters, devoted disciples, moaners, or missionaries. I'm not making any comment, but I would love us to read this passage from Luke chapter 24, and then I'm going to draw, I want to mention four things, and then hopefully relate that to your leadership and what goes on and within
PW groups and our lives as well. So Luke chapter 24, verse 13. Now that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. He asked them, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened here in these days?" "What things?" he asked. "By Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what's more, it's the third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us." There's a great line. There's a great hope, isn't it? "Some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning but didn't find his body. They came and told us that they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see Jesus. He said to them, 'How foolish you are and how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory?' And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself." As they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus continued on as if he was going further. But they urged him strongly, "Stay with us, for it is nearly evening. The day is almost over." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. They asked each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us?" They got up and returned at once to Jerusalem. There they found the 11 and those there with them, assembled together and saying, "It's true, the Lord has risen and has appeared to Simon." Then the two told what had happened on the way and how Jesus was recognized by them when he broke the bread. Amen. It's a strange question I'm about to ask, but what might you do if you had just been raised from the dead? What might the first thing that you did if you had just been raised from the dead? If I was suddenly walking, talking, living and breathing following a pretty horrific and public execution, my first response might be to schedule a press conference or to announce a stadium tour and to release my autobiography. That might be what I want to do. I would want to share it with as many people as possible because dramatic events deserve a vast audience, right? However, the Gospel of Luke records that the immediate response of Jesus after his resurrection was not to fill an amphitheater, but to walk out of town along a dusty road. He prioritized proximity. 4 things that Jesus did in this passage. He prioritized proximity. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them. And I love this picture of Jesus drawing alongside these doubting disciples and sharing himself with them as they walked side by side along the way. To be honest, this picture makes ministry for me way more achievable, way more realistic. Not drawing huge crowds, but drawn alongside a few. It's interesting that Jesus walked alongside them too. And I wonder sometimes if we build community with others best, not just by gazing into one another's eyes, not even by speaking at them from a distance, but by working shoulder to shoulder. There's some sort of alarm going off behind me. I don't know. Is that my time up already, is it? As they walked together and as they talked together and as they ate together, he taught them the things of the kingdom. And in their doubt, these disciples needed a guide to walk alongside them. It's interesting to me that Jesus chose not to impress these people with a story, but impress his story among his people. Let me say that again. He chose not to impress people with his story, but to impress his story upon his people. He chose not to preach to the masses in this moment, but to open the scriptures with a few. And not even a few really influential leaders, but just a couple, thanks, just a couple of doubting disciples about to lose hope. And yet Jesus saw these two as the perfect starting point for his post-resurrection ministry. You know, I don't know how you arrive here, or I don't know how you feel about your leadership in your group, but if whatever you do ever feels small, can I encourage you this morning that just because it's small does not mean that it's insignificant? Jesus shows this. He models this. If it was significant for Jesus to draw alongside two, then perhaps that helps us to see the significance of our ministry, of our leadership. Jesus invested in a small group that went on to impact the whole world. He prioritized proximity with people. He came close and he shared his life with them. And yet so often my life, maybe yours too, flows in the opposite direction. You can feel the pressure to build it bigger or to draw more. And yet Jesus invested in a few who went on to reach the many. Prioritize proximity in your leadership. Also, Jesus practiced presence. He asked them, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast. It wasn't a brilliant picture. It wasn't a pretty picture that Jesus met, and he had to be patient with them. And actually, his starting point wasn't telling them why they were wrong. His starting point wasn't telling them all the things that they should know. His starting point was their doubts and their questions. He was patient enough with them to start where they were rather than where they should be. And Jesus took time with them to unpack the story of the Bible with them. And it's clear that they didn't catch on straight away. You know how long it took them? 7 miles of walking. They walked for 7 miles. That's patience, okay? And then he still had to go inside and tell them more. He was patient with them, and he spent much of that time listening to their fears. He let them articulate their understanding, and he answered their question. Rather than jumping in from the start and telling them immediately, it's me, do you know who I am? He wanted to lead them to a place of encounter where they would discover the truth and discover Jesus for themselves. And this is hard. This is hard. We just want to grab people and we want to tell them and we want to shake them. But actually, I think leadership, disciple-making leadership, is patient, to model this kind of patience as we aim for spiritual growth. Not just to tell people the answers, but to help them for the truth to click with people and to push past the surface in what we were doing and aim for depth in people's lives. Spiritual growth takes time, persistence, patience. It requires us to be intentional. I want to encourage you this morning, like Jesus, to start with where people are at and push past, push beneath the surface. He also pursued presence. He went in to stay with them. So after walking 7 miles, I would say that was job done. You know, I would say that might have been enough. But Jesus pushed past that and he pursued presence. He went in to stay with them. And when he was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. In our second session later, we're going to think about this image a bit more. But I love that after a 7 mile journey, how Jesus lingered with them and he didn't rush away. He was invited in and he shared a meal with them. Jesus pursued presence with people. And Mark records that Jesus appointed 12. Why? That they might be with him. Jesus actually wanted to be with them. He didn't just want to speak to them. He didn't just want them to attend. He wanted to be with them. His discipleship method, I think, was as much about being with people as it was about It was as much about his disciples being with him as it was about them doing stuff for him.
And I don't know about you, but so often in my life, I'm prioritizing the activities I can do for Jesus. You know, the places I speak and the things I do and the activities I run and the programs I volunteer in church, all the activities that I can build up for Jesus, when actually I wonder if he's just wanting me to be with him. How are you pursuing presence with, not just for, but with Jesus? I do not doubt in this room that you are busy for Jesus. I have no doubts that you're active for him and that you are pouring your lives into programs and activities and meetings and organizations, and we say thank you. But if you're anything like me at times, I wonder if you need to be reminded to not just do for, but be with. I think we need to do this with people as well. We need to be present with people, to pursue presence with them, to be fully present with them, intentionally asking questions, listening to their concerns, opening our lives and opening our hands and opening our homes. I think it involves sharing our lives with those we are leading. It's actually about the people we're with more than the programs that we run. And lastly, in this little section, last observation about Jesus, and then we'll think about how this relates, these four things relate. He pushed participation. They got up, and by the way, I know pride is a sin, but I was so pleased to get four things that started not just with one P, but two P's. Okay, so we're doubling up this morning. But Jesus said, the story goes on, they got up and returned at once to Jerusalem. There they found the 11 and those with them assembled together and saying, it's true, the Lord has risen and appeared to Simon. And then the two told what had happened on the way. At the end of this story, what do we see? We find these two disciples back on the Emmaus Road once again, only this time they aren't crippled with doubt, but they are excitedly proclaiming Jesus. They had moved from being downcast and doubting to passionately proclaiming. They thought it was all over with Jesus, but now they were fully participating in his kingdom. And they said, were not our hearts burning within us on the road as he opened the scriptures to us? Their hearts were set on fire, and they immediately left where they were to tell people about Jesus. They became the missionaries themselves. What Jesus did in them, he began to do through them. Their hearts burned with fire in here, and then it took them outwards, and what he was doing in them, he began to do through them. I think for us to see people grow in our groups, I think we need to help people to see that they are participants and not just passengers. We need to move people from merely coming to church activities and instead help them to see how they can be personally involved in reaching out to a hurting world in need. Not just celebrating others who are doing it, but getting involved themselves. Jesus pushed participation because what he did in people, he wanted to do through people. And it's mind-boggling to me that Jesus did this. The Savior of the world, who could have done it all himself, chose to allow ordinary people to participate in his mission, and I don't think it's any different today. The Creator of the world, the Savior of the world, could do it all himself, and yet he chooses to involve people like me and you in his mission. So those are four things that Jesus did, but I want us to think, before my time is up in this first session, about how we can prioritize these things in our leadership and our groups. I think the first shift that I might require us to make, and maybe in our groups too, we need to move from just being at a distance to being in proximity or being up close. You know, if I'm personal for a moment, when I think about how I grew most as a young Christian or even a Christian at all, I don't think about programs. I don't think about projects. I don't even think about preaching, as important as that has been for me. When I think of my journey as a Christian, I think of people. I think of a teacher who talked with me honestly about the negative influences in my life as a teenager. I think about a youth leader who gave me opportunities to serve even when I didn't have a clue what I was doing, still don't. I think of an older couple who opened the doors of their home on a regular basis and modeled healthy marriage to me and my wife, fiance, girlfriend.
My first boss who taught me about leadership, and a friend I met on summer mission who modeled what it looked like to be someone who lived for God. Thanks to John, Mark, George and Anne, Helen, Dave, I was shaped, influenced, and encouraged in my faith. And what if I said that you all could do the same? What if you could be a George or a Helen to the people around you, in your group, in your congregation? What if no matter our age, our abilities, our experience, our knowledge, what if we could all play a significant part in someone else's journey of faith? Oh, it might not be to the masses, but it could be to a few. But these things don't happen from a distance. They happen in proximity. People are impressed from a distance, I find. People can be impressed from a distance, but I think they can only really be influenced up close. And Jesus demonstrated that making disciples was done up close. It was personal. It was involved in people's lives. He didn't just teach them from the front. He didn't sign them up for a class or give them a book to read. He actually took time to be with people and be a living example up close. And in fact, the whole story of the gospel is just that, a God who came close and became a living example to his people, not just reliant on writing his commands on tablets of stone, but becoming a living example, the incarnation among us. With Jesus, it wasn't just come and see, but it was come and be with me. Not just come and sit, but come and follow. How can you prioritize? Rhetorical question I'm asking, how could you prioritize this in your leadership of women and in the groups that you lead? Not just a come and see model, but a come and be with us model, come and learn among us model. 2 Timothy, Paul instructed Timothy to teach the truth to trustworthy people who would in turn pass them all to others. He was encouraging this young leader to be a disciple who makes disciples, who made more disciples, to pass on God's truth to individuals and be with them in proximity. And I love this quote that I read this week. Sophie DeWitt defines this, I think, as one Christian taking initiative with another to help them know Christ and obey him more fully through studying the scriptures, prayer, and sharing one's life with them, leaving the results to God. It's the way Jesus made disciples, not through a program, but by investing in people, not remaining at a distance, but coming close. It's the Emmaus Road way as he walked with relationship. How can you move closer to those you're leading? From distance to proximity. But how do we practice patience? I think we need to push from surface to depth. I don't know about you, but I think so often around church life, we can so often remain at the surface. You know, masks remain up, and we can remain in the shallow end. And sometimes that's needed as people come into our groups and as we build relationships. But I think we need to push past that to really help pursue depth, spiritual growth, not just superficial growth. And for me, the best picture of discipleship has already been mentioned by Fiona this morning. She stole my thunder, but I love it. She talked about discipleship being this picture of a learner. And in fact, this is the original, if you want to know the original word for a disciple, it means mathetes, which basically means to learn. It's to be a student of Jesus or a pupil or an apprentice. And you know, no matter how many years we've been going to church or following Jesus, there is always more for us to learn ourselves. But when I'm driving along the road and I see one of these, it might cause me slight fear, but as I drive along the road, there's something about this that tells me, and an L plate on a car acknowledges to the world that there's someone in that vehicle and they don't really know what they're doing. They're driving along the road and they're not, it tells me, it advertises to the world that there's someone in the driver's seat of that vehicle, and they're not competent enough to be left to their own devices. They need another. They need another alongside them, guiding them or helping them or braking for them at times. I don't know, but they need someone else alongside them. I think it's a picture for me of the Christian life. I'm not competent enough to be left to my own devices. I still need to learn. I have more to learn. I'm a student still. And I think we're to wear our L plates with pride. Model this posture to others. Carry this posture in leadership. we do not have it sorted. And I think for me, it takes the pressure off. It takes the pressure off me of having to perform or try to impress others or impress those that we lead. Perhaps it allows us to be vulnerable and acknowledge our weaknesses as leaders rather than our strengths. And perhaps it opens up the opportunity to engage with real issues and real conversations that go beyond the surface. How could you acknowledge to those that you lead with, those that you lead among, or those that you lead, that you're still learning some of these things that you're sharing? A few months ago after our service, finished one Sunday morning in our congregation, I was approached by an elder. We had a pretty ordinary conversation during which I shared that I was feeling stretched in my work. And we had a good chat together, and it wasn't anything dramatic. I wasn't breaking down in tears. I was just sharing some ordinary challenges that I was facing. And just before he walked away, he paused, and he asked if he could pray for me. And I said, yeah, it would be great if you could pray for me. And I was expecting him. I thought he was meaning this week. You know, can you pray for me this week? And he said, I'd like to pray for you now. And we sat down in a pew, and he prayed for me there and then. It was nothing spectacular, nothing dramatic changed in my life. There were still challenges that week, but I was so thankful for his prayer and his concerns. You know what he did? He pushed past beyond the surface. Oh, yeah, we all have challenges of work, of course. But he was patient with me. He started with my doubts and fears. He listened to me, and he pushed past the surface. What does that look like for you? And I'm not saying it means, you know, lots of prayer breaking out in the pews tomorrow morning, although it might. But how could you push from the surface to the depth in your leadership? A couple more, and then I'm done, okay? And then we're going to have a break. Golden words. Tea and coffee, I think. Am I right if I just promised it is tea and coffee, is it? Yeah, that's okay. I don't want to break a promise. From telling them to showing them, okay? I think this is what Jesus did. He pursued presence with them. And I think it's important for us to note that Christian ministry isn't just the discipleship, that leading people in discipleship isn't just about firing more information at them, but it's about demonstrate. It's not just about information, it's about demonstration. I think we need to move from just telling people, by the way, we really, really need to keep telling people, but we also need to show them as well. How am I going to teach my 5-year-old son to cross a road? How's that going to happen? Well, I could sit him down, and I could tell him all about these moving things that move about in the roads called cars, and he really needs to avoid them, okay? And I could tell him some stuff. I could sign him up to a road crossing class, Green Cross Code, I was thinking. I could sign him up to one of those classes, you know, you go along there and learn some, and then you'll be ready. Is that how I'm going to teach him? I might do some of those things. But what I'll probably do is take him to the side of a road and hold his hand and walk across the road with him countless times before I ever dare let him out of my grip. I won't just tell him. I'll show him. And hopefully he'll learn from me how to cross a road by watching me and then being able to do it for himself. Then how will we teach people how to read their Bible? Tell them to read their Bible? Yeah? How could we show them? How would we teach people how to share their faith? How would we teach people to be more generous? Will we tell them or will we show them? When I was a youth worker, I so often told teenagers that they needed to read their Bible. You're thinking, good. I so often stood up in front of a room and so many times I said, you need to read this book. If you want to grow in your faith, you need to read this. If you want to find out what God is speaking to you and communicating, you need to read this book. If you want to find out more about his character and his goodness, you need to read this book. And I did that on loads of occasions. Just because I said it, did they all do it? I think you know the answer. Some of them did. But I'm sad to say on far fewer occasions did I actually sit down beside a teenager and say, and here's how I read it. Or what questions do you have as you read it? We need to draw alongside people, showing people what it actually looks like. Have we told people to pray, or have we shown them how to? Oh, I couldn't do that. Are we challenging people to share their faith, or are we teaching them how to. Those we lead aren't just shaped by the things they hear, but by the things they see. And I believe we need to move from telling people what they need to do to showing them through practical example. And you know, I keep hearing about the barrier of a generation gap. I keep hearing about, you know, there's a challenge because there's such a gap between the generations. And then I watch my retired mother on her hands and knees on the floor playing with a five-year-old. Playing trains with a five-year-old. She's really well educated, by the way. Great job. Retired. Much older than him. What generation gap when I see that? You know, I believe we need to create opportunities where older and younger generations share together, get to know one another, and do life alongside each other and those who have different life experiences. I'm going to embarrass her, but Pauline wrote a blog this week that was on the PCI website, and I loved it all, but especially this little part. She said, quite often, though, younger women are not looking for more information or even more meetings, but instead they are longing that someone who has walked the path of faith would come alongside them as they walk theirs. I've seen that in my wife, to be honest. I've seen that in young people. It's a shifting from telling them, keep telling them, but also showing them. Pursue presence. And lastly, from passengers to participants. The old model, I think, of relying on people coming to us, we can't rely on that always. It's a different generation. Instead, Jesus actually had a different model. He didn't just rely on people to come to him, but he grew disciples who would go into the world. And it's been said that Jesus didn't tell all the world to come to the church, but he did tell all of the church to go into all the world. And that means that we all have a part to play. I think we're all to be participants. We're called to be servants, not spectators. Not passengers in the church, but participants in his kingdom. Everyone gets to play. If you're in Christ, then you have a part to play. And your role, and I really want to say this, your role isn't off to the side. Your role isn't off to the side while a few experts do the stuff. Your role isn't to be a picture of sport. You know, where a few experts play in the field and everyone else, you know, hundreds and thousands of people watch from the sidelines. And when people watch from the sidelines, we either critique the people who are playing or we consume it. If we're enjoying it, we consume it. And if we're not enjoying it, we critique it. I don't think that's to be our posture. We're actually to be on the pitch, not just the spectators of the people getting to play. Everyone gets to play. It's the whole body of Christ for the full work of God. And there's many churches that have a sign on the road where they gather or display key information about who they are. And it might declare the name of the congregation. And it might display a logo or share contact information, and in most cases communicates the name of the minister of the church. However, I once heard of a sign outside a church that read this, "Minister, all members," and I loved that. Because the sign was declaring that the job of ministry wasn't just for those who stand at the front, get paid, or take the lead, but the responsibility of ministry goes much deeper and far wider than any one leader. Of course, some people in the church are called to lead, but all people are called to minister. So who here is a minister? Newsflash, you all are. And knowing some of you and looking at some of you are delighted to tell your husbands that when you go home. Maybe as well. You see, now you might not all stand up at the front, preach the sermons, and that's okay. But the real work of leadership isn't just what happens in a platform. The real work of leadership is the friendly welcome of a newcomer. It's the inviting of a work colleague to a church event. It's the laser sharp prayer with someone who's struggling. It's the word of thanks to someone who has served. It's the meal being offered to a family in need. It's the question of how was your week to someone sitting beside you. The real work of leadership is done by those who silently and selflessly serve one another, pointing them to Christ by how they speak, by how they give, by how they live. At times it might mean walking across a room to say hello to someone that we don't know, or it might be stopping to ask someone how you could pray for them that week. At times it might be singing loudly and encourage someone who's doubting beside you, or using your gifts to serve in an area of need. And our works of service should also go beyond our gatherings. As we let Jesus impact our ordinary, everyday lives, we where we show love to a colleague, work well for an employer, live well in our local community, share faith with a friend, cook a meal for a neighbor. For me, this is a picture of everyday discipleship, moving from passengers to being participants, because every disciple isn't called to sit in a pew, but to participate in the mission of God. And I think we're called to this ourselves, but we're also called to it in our leadership, to somehow help people and create roles and opportunities for everyone to contribute and serve.